Well, thank you. And I should say, really, at the outset, this is really primarily the work of Tamar Klayman, the first author here. And she asked me to do the presentation because she's due to have a baby very soon. And given that she lives in Philadelphia, she may not have made it. She may be back on the East Coast with a guy from New York, too. So so I'm glad to have the chance to do this. I actually do have something to disclose, unlike most, and that is that the research was funded, actually it was Tamar's time, was funded by a grant from Pfizer Medical and Academic Partnership Program. Pfizer didn't have anything to do with the conduct of the research or the presentation or anything like that. We also have some support from RWJ for Tamar for the Assuring the Future of Public Health Systems and Services Research Faculty Development Award. And my time is supported by CDC through the Preparedness and Emergency Response Research Centers. I'd also like to thank members of my group at Georgetown who deal with public health systems research, and Chris Nelson from RAND, who we work a lot with. So the overview is that I'm going to say a little bit about the H1N1 vaccination campaign, to be clear a bit about the context, and I've used that word context deliberately, because that you'll see as we go forward. And then the second part of the talk, I'll be applying a methodology that's relatively new to public health, we think, called the positive deviance approach. And I hope that we'll have something substantive to say about public health emergency preparedness. But I also want to use this as an opportunity to illustrate an approach to rigorous qualitative analysis of public health systems as they respond to emergencies, which I think is an important area that needs development. So in terms of vaccine preparedness, going back to 2006, Congress approved $3.2 billion for vaccine preparation for pandemics. In May of 2009, shortly after the detection of a new pandemic outbreak, the Department of Health and Human Services agreed to purchase over $2 billion worth of H1N1 vaccine and set in place a process by which that would be distributed to people in the United States. And later that year, Public Health Emergency Response Funding, was given from CDC to state and local health departments to administer this vaccine. In the end, this was the largest vaccine campaign in history, with over 75 million people vaccinated. It worked because the federal government distributed the vaccine to the states and to the local governments, and it was essentially administered at the local level. It was done in very different ways across the country in different counties and cities and towns. Some focused on schools, some worked with healthcare primary care and other healthcare providers. And in some cases, health departments set up public clinics. And that's the public clinics are the topic I'll be speaking about today. We have another paper looking at using the same approach to look at school-based clinics. So when you look at what happened in the big picture, this shows in the top the vaccine coverage rates for children under age 18, and in the bottom for adults 18 and over, both with the same shading for both. And you can see that coverage rates was higher for children, which is not surprising since children were thought to be primarily at risk, but higher for children than for adults. But within either group, there's a lot of variation across the different states. And you probably would find variation within states if you saw it. There's lots of reasons for that variation. But one of the reasons for the variation may be the approach that was taken. So in particular, we do a lot of work in Massachusetts. And so we were particularly interested in comparing the vaccination rates in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. And for children, Rhode Island did substantially better, almost 85 versus 60% compared to Massachusetts. But for adults, it was the other way around, with Massachusetts doing better. Why is that? Well, one possibility is that Rhode Island focused almost all of its efforts on schools. And so What you do matters. And so part of what this talk is about is trying to figure out what works in these kind of circumstances. Now, of course, the challenge is we can't do randomized clinical trials of things like this, and many of the kind of statistical studies that we're used to are challenging because we feel you have to really understand what's going on in individual places, understand the context, understand how the mechanism that was chosen by the health departments interrelates with that context to give useful, good positive outcomes. So one particular approach to that is this approach called the positive deviance approach, better than the negative deviance, I suppose. But and the idea is this. It's a framework that begins by identifying top performers and then learns from them. What do they have in common? And we define top performers a bit loosely as those that demonstrate consistently exceptional performance, or maybe performance that's greater than might be expected. This idea, this approach, originated in public health with the concept that interventions could be designed around healthy behaviors that some community members practice. There are stories about this being used in India, I think it was, where they discovered that people who ate a certain kind of rice along with something else, that the babies that were healthiest also were having something along with their rice. And the question was, what do they all have in common? So it's traditionally been used in individual and community behavior, and we run, but it's now being extended to learn from healthcare organizations and community health programs, and we want to sort of bring it into public health. There are four steps in the classic approach to positive deviance. One is to identify the positive deviants, the ones that perform beyond expectations. Two is to study these organizations in depth using qualitative methods to generate hypotheses about practices that allow organizations to develop top performance. That's our focus in this paper here. But ultimately, what we'd like to be able to do is to test these hypotheses in future disease outbreaks and similar situations where health departments are called upon to distribute vaccines or other countermeasures. So the objective for this research was to use this positive deviance approach to learn from exceptional events to improve future responses. We began by identifying local health departments that were successful in vaccine administration. And unfortunately, if we had data like I showed you for the states that showed the vaccine vaccination rates in all these different counties, that would be great to identify the top performers. Those data generally don't exist. So what we really did was we began by talking to people in public health practice, talking to people in Natrel and so on. I'll say a bit about that in a moment, to identify some top performers. And then we want to conduct an in-depth analysis of these top performers. So we began by reviewing the model practices database that NACHO maintains. We looked through state and local after-action reports that we had access to. We looked at reports in the media and the literature and other kind of published reports. We spoke with health department staff around and asked about, tell me who you know, who you think did a good job. Part of this approach recognizes that practitioners have some knowledge and wisdom, and that part of what we're trying to do is to capitalize on the knowledge that those practitioners have in a systematic and a rigorous way. And part of that is to identify the ones that performed well. I mean, like as I said, if we had a list of actual vaccination rates, that would be great. But this is what we could do. We ended up with 35 local health departments that we tried to reach. And then we developed a process map that basically lays out the different steps that are involved in setting up a vaccine clinic at a local health department. Determining priority groups, choose a specific location. I'm not going to go through all these things in detail. But the point here is that we thought about this systematically, what needs to be done. And then we used this framework to, when we interviewed these local health departments, to say, how did you deal with these issues? Did that work well? Did you have problems here? That's part of being systematic, to sort of lay these things out this way. So we had a semi-structured interview protocol that was based on this process map. We took notes and typed them up immediately before we lost track of what they said. And then we used this process map as domains to identify some key themes. And what I want to tell you about is some of the results that came from that. We did these interviews in 20 local health departments, and this analysis is based on 15 of those departments that conducted public clinics. The ones that school clinics are in another analysis. They range from small to large, in a number of different states, and the number of employees at these health departments range from 2 to 1,800. So we had pretty good heterogeneity here in our sample. We wouldn't say that this is a representative sample, and in fact, it was not our intention to have a representative sample. It was intention to have a high-performing sample. But we wanted to have some variety within that sample. And the way that we identified the results and presented them is in terms of these what we call CMO stories. It's not our word. It goes back to two British evaluation specialists, Pawson and Tilley, who developed an approach called realist evaluation. And they say, what we need to do is identify what about the context, that's the C, and what about the mechanism that was employed by the health department? How do they interact to yield a positive outcome? The idea is that mechanisms don't apply across the board. What works in a small health department may not work in a large health department. So what we tried to do was to identify some of these contexts by listening carefully to what the health department staff said, seeing if we see it, the same kind of thing show up in a number of different contexts. So everything that that I show here is something that made sense, and we saw it maybe in two or three different settings where the same general approach method and the same context seemed to have come together. So, for instance, I'm not going to go through all these, but let me just give you a couple of examples. The first one is where there were vulnerable populations locally. There was access to these vulnerable populations through particular things like homeless shelters or nursing homes and so on. And if the health department worked with these organizations, they seemed to have done a better job in terms of increasing their vaccination rate. Another example was in a small local health department that had a large Orthodox Jewish community. So rather than holding clinics on Saturday, they said, let's think about that. They're not going to be able to come. Let's hold them on Sundays. And so the more general version of that is to think about the availability of your community. Sometimes that is thinking through, is it better to work to have clinics that are in the evening or during the weekend, depending on when you think that the different populations may be there. You know, this is not rocket science, but this is the kind of careful thinking and systematic thinking that public health practitioners are pretty good at. And what we want to do is to try to identify some of these practices. So in terms of communicating with the public, we found that, for instance, that when there were public questions and concerns, that local health departments that set up a hotline and a website were successful in informing the public. A number of the rural health departments that we studied borrowed road signs from the police as an effective way to notify people exactly where the clinic was. And it seemed to have drawn people in. In terms of staffing, a small local health department with a large population and trained Medical Reserve Corps staff was able to call those reservists in to staff the clinics. In another health department where there were multiple clinics that had to be staffed and there were a number of local professional schools of nursing and other professions, they found that getting those students to help with the clinics was an effective mechanism. So these are the kind of things that we saw. Community partnerships that when there were existing members of understanding with particular venues. It was easy to get them going rather than have to set it up in advance. And I think maybe the most important one is flexibility. High demand for a vaccine plus a large community event such as a county fair led to a high vaccination rate. One of the things we saw in a related study, we did a study about the island of Martha's Vineyard that was planning to have one island-wide clinic as soon as all the vaccine arrived. When the vaccine didn't arrive in a big bunch like everyone had thought it would, they said, okay, let's switch to a school-based program where they did one school at a time, where they had everybody from the whole island would converge onto one school. And the question was, what school should it be first? And the answer was, if we got 200 doses of the vaccine that day, we're going to go to the school with 200 kids. And that was seen as efficient in that it got everybody to work together rather than just that school staff. And fair, because no one knew in advance which school was going to get it first. It was based on something outside of their control. But flexibility, that's just one example. But flexibility, I think, really turns out to be a critical characteristic. So, of course, nothing is perfect, and there are lots of problems with this method. It's done this recall bias. We did this. We did the interviewing long after the events in question. We think that in the future, it's really important to be able to go in and ascertain the facts soon after the events, and we're working to try to do that. It's difficult to test hypotheses. We're really laying out hypotheses here, and they shouldn't be regarded as anything like that. But they're possible to test in the future. And the other limitation, of course, is that we only focus on the positive deviants, the ones that went well. We thought, could we go in and try to identify health departments where things didn't go well? And we figured they probably wouldn't want to be too open about talking to us about those things. But finding a way to do that, I think, is useful. And maybe one way to do that is to identify ones that where things generally went well, but recognize that some things didn't go well within those and learn from those as well. So what we found, raising it up one level of generality, is that clinic success during the H1N1 in 2009 depended on having clearly defined priority groups in advance and sticking to them when people tried to go around that system. Effective communication with the public, and we found lots of different ways of communicating with the public that depended on the context where people were working. Staffing, again, we needed people to staff these clinics, but how you got those staff depended on the context of what resources that you had. Partnerships, having arrangements in place beforehand with different venues, and flexibility, as I was talking about just a moment ago. And again, it's really the context that says what version of staffing and partnerships and flexibility was really important in any given set. And we have to really think through. It's not just mechanisms that work across the board, but mechanisms that work in certain contexts and understanding those. So that's the conclusion methodologically is that we think that this method offers a new way of learning from success in the kind of events like pandemics and public health emergencies more generally that we can't replicate and study them statistically. The findings show that the success depends on using local resources effectively in specific contexts. And I think the other thing here is that sometimes researchers often try to take an arm's length relationship with the practitioners that they're studying, figuring that somehow if they don't do that, they'll be biased. We think that there really is a lot to be gained from the opposite, where a real and this is true of the this is a big point in the Pawsett and Tilley realist evaluation perspective at all, that the real learning comes from the engagement between the public health practitioners and the researchers to understand what really was going on, and that just asking people questions in a questionnaire in a survey doesn't usually get to that depth of understanding that really is necessary to understand what's happening and to learn from these events. So, thank you.